privilege. I'm an economist working for the Kuga Development Corporation. These days I head the capital and funding office, so my main focus is on financing large infrastructure projects both in South Africa and in Africa.
The role of women in the energy sector is not to be underestimated, nor is their contribution to multi-million dollar utilities across Africa. During this Women in Energy podcast series, we're going to be talking with a number of leading women in Africa's power sector, showcasing their influence, the unique elements they bring to their jobs, and provide a little insight into the woman behind the title. As part of our monthly focus on women in energy, we are speaking this month to Micah Vetch, head of the Capital and Funding Office from the Kuga Development Corporation. Micah, thank you so much for joining us. It is, as always, amazing to have the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could give us a bit of an idea on your background and how it is that you got to where you are. I mean, specifically, how did you get involved in the economics of energy and your role at Kuga?
And my first job was to contribute to the development of a transnational forestry plan in the far northern area of KwaZulu-Natal for the United Nations. This was at the time when the Mozambican Civil War came to an end. From there, I then went into financial markets. And at that stage, I was involved in financing one or two energy projects in the United States and also the United Kingdom. And then I came back to South Africa, first spending a little stint at Rhodes, then going into private business, and finally landing at the Kuga Development Corporation. My first project relating to energy at Kuga Development Corporation was the then planned project Dumbo. And at that stage, we were looking at the capital spend analysis, and we sort of started saying to ourselves, look, you know, out of a proposed $11 billion transaction, and that was about the size of it then, how do we improve the capital spend, the localization of the capital spend? And we started working with the engineering team. We changed some of the engineering specifications without impacting the integrity of the plant. And we've managed to get that localization spend up from 2.6 billion to roughly about 4.8 billion US dollars, which for the Eastern Cape economy would have been quite the manufacturing stimulus. But there were other issues with that particular business case. And Project Mtumbo is still in the planning phases. From there, I then started working together with colleagues on the Karoo Shale project. I'm currently involved in oil and gas. I'm doing a bit of work in support of the development of the water master plan. And then did quite a lot of work for NYASA around the localization and financing of the then proposed nuclear deal. And these days, it's really oil and gas. Kuga has subsequently been nominated as the National Oil and Gas Hub for the country. So we are doing a lot of work with Transnet and with the Central Energy Fund around developing a gas economy.
Can I ask if you could perhaps just expand a little bit on the role of Kuga as a national oil and gas hub and what that means for the country, for the economy, and particularly for the Eastern Cape?
Well, I think at the outset, it is important to note that Kuga is one of the role players. We do our work together with Transnet National Ports Authority and also, of course, Transnet, the Provincial Department of Economic Affairs, Environment and Tourism, who has taken the lead in developing the oil and gas master plan for the province. We also work with national organizations like the Central Energy Fund and other players, including both public and private sources of finance. The key issue here is to find a reliable, industrial quality, good baseload using the existing resources that we have. There are tremendous opportunities arising from not only the Angolan and the Mozambican gas field, but there's also been a number of significant finds around our own coast. And the key thing here is that in resolving our energy problems, we also need to do so in a manner that stimulates economic growth and the all-important job creation local income multipliers, localization of that value chain, and it is around the achievement of energy diversity. So as an industrial development zone, Kucha plays a role in working with these organizations in terms of developing the downstream economies, in terms of negotiating some of the key deals that would go into an economy like that, and also in ensuring that the economic planning is such that we can actually achieve the results that we're after.
Thanks very much. Now, perhaps a slightly different take on your role, if I may, and the concept of a woman in. So be that as a woman in economics or in energy, but basically just the role of woman in business. I mean, do you think that this is a relevant topic or a relevant conversation to be having in terms of the role of woman in?
Definitely. If I can zone in on the energy sector in particular, the energy sector's gender gap is glaringly large. It's also quite interesting that data is quite scant in terms of the participation of women in energy as on an aggregate basis and on a global basis. One of the earliest adopters, interestingly, is my own core field, which was financial. We've seen that the financial industries have achieved quite a bit in terms of gender transformation and gender diversity. But in terms of other sectors, for example, the energy sector ranks dead last for gender diversity on corporate boards. Now, why is that an issue? The issue is that if you consider that roughly about 1.1 billion people in the world do not have access to modern forms of energy, and that the World Energy Council scenarios work tells us that we're not on the right path to eradicate energy poverty. And the bulk of those people suffering from energy poverty are, in fact, women. We need to reach out as a collective, because without energy, there can be no adequate healthcare, sanitation, education, economic growth, job creation. And the point, you know, the elimination of energy poverty will involve many actors and multiple solutions. And the big strength that women brings to this particular conversation is, in fact, their networking ability, is, in fact, their embrace of diversity. And we need to find solutions here. Now, collectively, we must reach out to women who suffer from energy poverty and also other women in the economy. And the involvement at all levels of women is essential to improve quality of life. And we must also be careful that we don't focus on only poor countries and emerging economies. For example, in the United States, literally just 5% of Fortune 500 CEOs are women, and only 17% on corporate board seats, and 25% in management positions are held by women, even though women make up nearly half the workforce. And that is the point. The point is that we, you know, it's not women per se. The issue is diversity. It's the diversity of perspectives. It is the ability to look at a problem from many different angles. It is the ability to come up with a solution that speaks to multiple stakeholders. And there, I believe that inclusion and the embrace of diversity, both in terms of gender, in terms of race, in terms of age, in terms of many other criteria, can actually benefit the ultimate solution and the quality thereof.
With, I mean, all of that in mind, what do you believe your role is as a woman leader in both the energy and the finance sector, particularly, I would say, in a South African context?
First of all, to do the job. You know, to do the job, to deliver the results, I think what we also need to do, and this is what I try to do, is to say that, okay, well, how does a project differ in its substantive and overall outcome when a woman leads that? And let me try and build that case. On a macro level, it means that we are going to have to start finding ways to reach the full value of more than half of the world's labor pool. That's what women are. How we can assist other women and our colleagues to bring that balanced mix of leadership strengths. We are currently wasting significant talents because organizations still don't know how to lead this team. And You know, it's as much as you sort of focus on your own set of deliverables, it has been said, and there's merit in that statement, that women tend not to support other women. And there's various reasons being advanced. But for myself, it is a question of saying, well, okay, as much as you are being embraced, what are you doing to embrace others? What are you doing to set a woman leadership profile? Because the way a woman leads is very different. A way a woman relates to and uses authority and uses networking and conceptualizes is very different. And there's a very specific gendered leadership style that I believe organizations can benefit from. That how do we forge that path and how do we make it accessible to others? That is pretty much where I would say.
Thanks very much. I guess then the question that I'd like to ask as a follow-on to that is, what is the message that you would like to share with, I was going to say young women, but perhaps it's more just a case to women out there who are wanting to either get into the engineering or power or economics sector?
I'm going to start with a quote from Christine Lagarde, currently the head of the European Central Bank, erstwhile head of the International Monetary Fund, used to be a lawyer with Goldman Sachs and Minister of Finance in France. And she made the statement, she said, when women are called to action in times of turbulence, it is often on account of their composure, their sense of responsibility, and their great pragmatism in delicate situations. And we've seen this. We've seen this in very recent months, in how women leaders have responded to the economic aftermath and the crises and the societal breakdown that this COVID shock has brought on both our societies and our economies. And this is your superpower. As a woman, this is your superpower. We are pragmatic. We are able to embrace perspective. We are able to network. We are able to relate. And my message to you is twofold. First of all, look at the woman next to you. Look at the women who report to you and look at the women that you report to and start finding ways to truly embrace and to truly connect with those women and to build a network of support. And in doing that, find a way to include men in the conversation. We have to normalize our conversation with men. We have to stop looking at men as the enemy. And I see this in a lot of corporate discourse, where men are almost othered and so on. That is not the path to balance. You can achieve a beautiful balance in organization. Find that way to embrace men, but embrace them in a way that brings a diversity of perspective and brings an egalitarian thing. In terms of if you're a young woman, know when you are in the presence of a mentor. Let me explain what a mentor is. It is a woman who cares enough about you and about your future to not accept you as you are. And I'm going to say that again, to not accept you as you are. She's not going to cheerlead you out of political correctness. She's going to give you a very hard time. She's going to make you rework things. She's going to relentlessly pursue you until you do your best work. And you probably, in many days, are going to find that quite a difficult relationship to work through. But that is the woman who lays your foundation. That is the one who demands your best. Mm-hmm. And that is the one you thank when you grow up. She's not a mindless cheerleader. She's not your friend, but she is the person who will lay a basis for you because she's trying to leave a legacy, and that's quite important to her and it is important to you. Be that woman to ones who are younger than you.
It's actually funny, you know, you saying that makes me realize that I had one of those women. And you're right, it is sometimes a difficult relationship to work through. But definitely the benefit of hindsight makes you realize just how lucky you were to have that person in your life because of the fact that they pushed you sometimes beyond the point where you necessarily felt you could manage. But everything that you do now is largely driven by the example and the foundation that they provided with, for you.
Absolutely. Now, their job is to stretch you. And their job is for you to overcome your own limitations. And that is a hard boot camp. But that is the road to excellence.
I guess if we all stayed within our comfort zones, nothing would ever change.
Absolutely.
So taking on the fact that as a woman, you, I mean, for many women, your day doesn't just begin and end when you walk into the office. There is a lot of other stuff that's going on. And I wanted to kind of find out how is it that you manage your work-life balance? And what do you do to recharge yourself when you actually have some downtime?
I think it starts with the thing of I don't see my work as something separate from myself. Work is just another stage where you get to express yourself and where you get to learn and where you get to relate and where you get to stretch. So it's not a separate thing. So work and family for me has never been separate. Work and friends has never been separate. So it's sort of a general symphony and sort of if you can use the image of a symphony orchestra. You know, sometimes the violins come in, sometimes the timpanis come in, and so forth and so further. And that makes the symphony of your life. In terms of achieving balance, like any good symphony, you do bring in different parts of the orchestra depending on what the particular piece of music demands. And the key thing there is flexibility. And the key thing there is also always to center yourself, to anchor yourself. I've got a very active family life. I've got quite a number of little ventures that I support and that I work with in my private time. I'm an avid reader. I'm currently trying to learn to play the piano. It sounds absolutely awful. My neighbors haven't started throwing stones on my roof yet. And it's all about a sense of humor. And I think if you've got enough laughter and if you've got enough wine in your life, you can deal with a hell of a lot.
I remember being in primary school and trying to learn the piano. And one of the things that kind of stopped me from doing it is I don't have beautiful, long, elegant fingers. My fingers look a little bit more like pork sausages than anything else. And it was the teacher taking my fingers and trying to stretch them across the keys and then banging down on them as she was doing it, that kind of put pay to any real effort that I made to learn the piano. But when I hear somebody who has that ability, I'm just like, oh, I wish that I'd persevered. But it's never too
You
late,
know,
right?
it's never too late. And as a matter of fact, one of the reasons why I enjoy it so is, you know, it's often I do things incredibly fast. And if you sort of, you know, have been doing your thing for the last 30 years, you tend to almost do it reflexively. And in many cases, I've lost the ability to slow down. And when you sit and you read a piece of music, and you can absolutely read the piece of music, you understand it, and so on, and now you've got to train your fingers to do that thing, that little Baroque thrill. You've got to work with timing that doesn't always, and sort of go with your natural instinct. It forces you to slow down, and it forces you to become patient with yourself. Because it's what you read and what you physically can do with your hands is a disconnect, and I think that also is quite relaxing. But I think I've also become a much better aunt to my 2-year-old nephew, because I now realize but sometimes simple things can be really hard. You know, if you read the piece of music, it's not that hard. Try and get your fingers to do that. It takes a while.
The coordination and the ability of your brain to say, oh, that's so simple, and the ability of your fingers to keep pace with what your brain is saying is easy. Not always the same
Exactly.
thing. You just need to see me trying to do a Zumba class. You'll understand where the disconnect
it's in my neighborhood, Blue Water Bay, here in Port Elizabeth. We've decided, I mean, some of us have sort of given into the middle age spread, so we've decided to drop the Zumba classes and we started the Blue Water Bay Belly Dancing Club.
Oh.
There's lots of cocktails involved. And various children want to climb under, literally under the carpets. But we're having an, you know, it's amazing fun. And it also gives us a chance to sort of try and do our Arab moves and laugh at ourselves and dribble our billies.
I like that. I believe the other thing that has actually also really started taking off, and I know is responsible for some incredibly toned musculatures, is pole dancing.
Okay.
You know, whatever it takes, right? One of our local dance studios has actually started tap for adults. Which I think is probably quite good for your legs, and again, though, requires a completely different type of coordination between your brain and the movement of your feet.
No, absolutely. I'm still stuck on the pole dancing, though. You know, it's I'm a very visual thinker, and I thought to myself, but that's almost gymnastics. I mean, what those women do.
I know, it's incredible.
It's like yoga and gymnastics combined, eh?
Yeah, I know. I remember a very long time ago going to a strip club in New Orleans, and just being absolutely blown away by the physicality of these girls on the stage. And yeah, just how incredibly toned they were.
No, absolutely. But the pre-qualification, I mean, just again thinking what they are physically capable of, is I think if you can hold the plank for about an hour, you should be able to do pole dancing. not for this lesser mortal. I can't do that.
The only way I can hold the plank for an hour is if I'm lying on the floor. Mikael, I was wondering then if you could sort of give me an idea of who your inspiration is.
I often, you know, sort of ask myself this question, typically in airport lounges when I've run out of things to do. And I sort of say to myself, well, okay, if I could throw a dinner party and I could invite any living or historical figure to compose that dinner party, and I've come up with some really weird guest lists. Mm-hmm. But let me start with two historical figures. The first one being the good Katharina der Große, the Catherine the Great, is a woman that turned Russia from a backwater into a world empire. And she did that by understanding that if you want to freeze in the north, Russia has to have a presence in the Middle East. And that's a doctrine that they still hold to this day. But the interesting thing in terms of how she did that, yes, there was a lot of wars of conquest and things like that, but the manner in which she managed her court, her diplomatic networks, you know, is on par with what Otto von Bismarck did, the unification of Germany. In terms of living figures, if you want to look at politicians, I've got a tremendous admiration for the way that Angela Merkel has done her 16 years as Germany's longest serving chancellor. And at the end of 16 years, to have the German population applaud her for the work that she has done, literally. And she's pushed a number of boundaries, and she brought humanity back to Europe with her statement to say that, look, if your neighbor is in trouble, you don't and needs a home and needs refuge, then you don't make a face about it. You open your door. And to say that in Germany, that for me was one of the great redemptive moments that we've seen in European history. Mm. But also in the manner that she's dealt with several world leaders, that she's dealt in terms of strategy. She's an absolute master of strategy. In terms of other fields, I'm a great follower of Peter Diamandis, a brilliant entrepreneur. He's the one who founded the XPRIZE Foundation, which has given millions of dollars to improve the health of our oceans, and also is part of the Singular University, whose mission it is to educate leaders to apply exponential technologies to address the biggest challenges we face today. This is a man who sees tomorrow. This is a man who's ushering in a tomorrow that we cannot see yet. And, in terms of leadership style, almost a watchman on the wall, he who looks far. And without minds like that, the rest of us would still be crawling in the mud. Mm-hmm. And then a great fan of Dan Ariely, I wouldn't say the founder of behavioral economics, but from doing live tests with real humans to see if high-priced fake medicines outperforms low-priced medicines, the power of perception on purchasing decisions. And he's done quite a lot of work. He's been called revolutionary. He's a Nobel laureate in economics, but one of the really enjoyable economists of our times. If you have the chance, look at one of his TED Talks or perhaps pick up one of his books. But the mark of true competence has always been if you can explain the most complicated concept in your field in a manner that a six-year-old can understand you, then you are truly competent. Mm-hmm. And Dana really is one of those people.
I love his books. I love his personal kind of backstory. I always think that the way he writes is so incredibly, well, as you say, it's so relatable. You know, he doesn't try to talk above you. And I think I have three of his books, and I'm always very interested in what he has to say. I haven't kind of read any of or seen any of his TED Talks, but I think that will be on the list of things that I need to do sometime today, because I just love the concept of behavioral economics and how you know, how human behavior, I guess for me that's really what it is how human behavior causes us to do so many things. It's either from an economic perspective or most recently in my personal life from a true crime perspective. I'm kind of giving into my true crime obsession here, but it's all about what makes us do the things that we do.
But you know what, at the heart of it, and this is what I so enjoy about this man, economics started and still is all about how human beings interact with the marketplace, how we make our lives, how we compete with each other, how we prosper, how we solve the problems of poverty. And it started as basically one of the humanities. Along the way, and I'm also a great admirer of John Maynard Keynes, we put some math to it to explain the human behavior. And then somehow, somewhere, we lost the human element. And Dana really is the guy who brings us back in a very visceral way to say, no, but hang on a moment, this is what economics really is. Another man who also does that through numbers is Nouriel Roubini, who I thoroughly enjoy, but not quite as accessible. But this is what economics is. It's really a discipline that cares about people. That's why you become an economist. You want to solve the problem of poverty.
Well, that certainly helped me rethink the whole kind of role of economics and what it is. You know, if you reframe it as solving the problems of humanity, it looks like a very different topic than I think.
And Wolf of Wall Street.
Exactly. I was going to say, or the guy that you hear on the news talking about what the markets are doing, because that just seems a little bit boring. But when you put it into, well, how is this going to affect people? It's a very different conversation. So speaking of people like Dan Ariely, what book are you reading at the moment? Or what is your favorite book and why?
Well, currently I'm reading two books, and it's part of a development program that we're currently running at the Kuga Development Corporation. And so the first one is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, We Should All Be Feminists. And then one of my favorites of all times have been Steve Biko's I Write What I Like. And the reason for that is the masterful way he uses the rhetoric, and he uses the dialectic in the tradition of Frantz Fanon, and I really enjoy masters of reason like that. You know, my favorite of all times, believe it or not, is Julius Caesar, Gallic Wars, which is all about asymmetrical warfare. And it talks about the time of the Gauls. Most children will know the Gallic Wars as the topics of asterisks and Obelix comic books. Mm-hmm. But once again, also a master of the narrative. I've never been, fond of the Aristotelian type of dialogue, but this tradition of dialogue truly appeals to me.
Any lessons that you've taken from those that you're applying to your life?
At this stage, yes, actually there's a lot. I think, it's difficult to say, well, I learned this thing and I'm applying it. So I think it just really shaped the way that I think. Mm. And it also really shaped the way that I assess a situation and that I look at potential solutions. Like I summarized it to one of my interns the other day when they said to me, well, what is your competitive strategy? And we were talking about chess. And my response to him was, when you play chess and when you talk to play conventional chess, the objective of the game is to dominate the middle of the board. And that's why you see things like the Queen's Gambit and the Sicilian Defense and all of that. They've watched the movie. But what I particularly like is to play the spider. What you are prepared for is somebody wanting to dominate the center of the board. What you are not prepared for is a relentless campaign of seduction on the fringes that absolutely influences everything that happens on the center of the board. That's my place of comfort. And this is sort of the thing that comes out of the books that I've just spoken to, and specifically Gallic Wars. I'm really a fond reader of Gallic Wars.
Well, I haven't read Gallic Wars, but I think I should certainly give it a go and see whether or not that is going to influence my ability, such as I have, to play chess. Last question, if I may, and that is, what message would you like our listeners to take away from our discussion today?
We are living in such a wonderful time. I think we're pretty much at the same point where the Victorians were, roughly about the 1900s, when it was the beginning of mass mechanization. It was the birth of the material Newtonian world. And it was this era of innovation and this era of innovation in finance, in terms of global reach and so on. The parallels there is that we are at the cusp of redefining what it means to be human, redefining what it means to be a global citizen. We're starting to see national identities dissipate. We're starting to see the ushering in of a very brave new world. We are at the cusp of a major transition in terms of the adoption of 4IR, not only in terms of what that would mean for technology, but also for society and the way we relate to each other. And these are the early birth pangs, but this entire era is fraught with opportunity. There is so much opportunity that surrounds us, and it is perhaps the best time to be alive. And I think we're all just we are so privileged to be here. Typically, the eras of transitions come with major shifts. It's not unlikely that we'll probably see another major financial crisis, perhaps in the sovereign bond market. But this is the era where we redefine our economics, where we redefine the way society works. And to be in that position where you can create the next 300 years of humanity and to be part of that generation is just such a privilege, and there's just so much opportunity out there. And my message is embrace this. Embrace this, dance in the storm. Embrace this, because this is an opportunity to actually bring forth whatever you wanted to.
Well, I love that. And I think that is an amazing sentiment on which to end our discussion. Micah, thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat with me. I am so looking forward to the opportunity for us to get together in person. And thank you so very much for sharing your insights with our audience as well.
And thank you for your time, Claire.
Thank you for joining us on this Enlit Africa podcast. This episode is brought to you in partnership with ESI Africa. For more podcasts, you can visit the Enlit Africa website at enlit-africa.com or visit the ESI Africa website, esi-africa.com. Be sure to tune in again for more conversations and insights into the things that really matter to Africa's energy industry. Until next time, I'm Claire Falkveen, and you've been listening to the Women in Energy podcast.
From there, I then went into financial markets, and at that